Sponsorship for this KQED live audio stream comes from Brevo, helping businesses work smarter, not harder, to help deliver customer experiences across email, SMS, WhatsApp, and more. Learn more at brevo.com. That's brevo.com.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Health Dialogues. On today's show, the wave of baby boomers starting to turn 65. As they become eligible for Medicare, how will they affect the healthcare system seniors now rely on?
Well, we have a generation of very high maintenance, high expectation people reaching a system that needs to adjust to the economic reality of all those people coming in.
Medicare helps older Americans get affordable health care, but many boomers don't realize that in most cases, Medicare doesn't cover things like in-home services or long-term care.
And when you're living on a fixed income and you're looking at paying for in-home or caregiver services, those can become very expensive very quickly.
Baby boomers and the future of Medicare. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is Health Dialogues. We'll get started right after this. And welcome once again to Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer. At each stage of their lives, baby boomers, officially Americans born between 1946 and 65, have had a huge effect on American life. From the public schools they attended, to the social and political causes they championed, and the music they listened to, boomers have been a force to be reckoned with. Well, now, as they begin turning 65, baby boomers are about to influence Medicare, the federal health insurance system for seniors. But how? Will they overwhelm Medicare with their sheer numbers? Will they force innovations to make the system better? We begin with one baby boomer navigating all this as he becomes eligible for Medicare. Reporter Kelly Weiss has that story.
Puzzle boxes, Medicare, they have a lot in common for Jim Thompson. He's a craftsman and works out of a shop in the Sierra foothills town of Grass Valley. He imports puzzle boxes and fixes them up to sell at craft fairs, like the Renaissance Festival. They're wooden and look kind of like a jewelry box. They have interlocking pieces that you have to find and move and slide around to locate the lock. The challenge, Thompson says, is to get to the inside of the box.
However, there's a little problem with this one. It doesn't open.
He's still mulling over how to fix it, but he says it's nothing compared to picking a Medicare plan. He has a little bit of a head start. He's self-employed and has had to learn a lot about how to get health coverage.
Well, because I have had to buy my own insurance for the good part of my life since I work for myself, and watching the fees go to the point where, well, now it's $10,000 a year for my medical insurance.
Thompson says Medicare will only cost him a few thousand dollars a year.
Just looking forward to it was this dream. Medicare is coming. It won't cost me my biggest bill anymore to pay for health insurance.
Thompson takes about 5 prescription drugs, some for high blood pressure and cholesterol. The others are ointments to keep his skin condition, psoriasis, under control. But even with Medicare, he's looking at a big expense for the skin creams. They're brand name drugs, and one costs $850. To crunch the numbers and find the best option, Thompson has an advantage, his wife. Karen Hoffland is a volunteer Medicare counselor at a HICAP office. These nonprofit organizations can be found around the state and the country. Congress created them to help explain Medicare benefits. Hoffland starts where millions of seniors do, with a rather large booklet that arrives in the mail. There are smiling seniors on the cover, and it's called Medicare and You.
It's got 138 pages, but the print is really large.
Hoffland helps people digest it, including her husband. She frequently reassures people that they're not stupid. She says she even helps dazed doctors, lawyers, and professors with Medicare enrollment.
You know, there is so much information that people have to absorb, and you can't just throw it all at them and expect them to retain it.
So Hoffland says she breaks down the information.
What I do is I'll tell them, first of all, explain what Medicare is. Original Medicare is Parts A, and I'll draw an A. Part B, and I'll draw B, looks kind of like building blocks, and that's sort of what it is.
She's sketching out a simple flow chart.
And I'll explain that Part A covers basically your hospital care. Part B covers outpatient care, doctor's office visits. And then you have Part D, D for drugs.
And Hoffland says if seniors want everything in one, forgetting the blocks, they can go for a Medicare Advantage plan. It usually bundles everything together. She says in this rural Nevada County area, the local HICAP office helps about 15 seniors a month. And it's important to remember that each person should carefully consider what they need. She's giving advice to her husband, Jim Thompson, about a roughly $80 a month option that doesn't include prescription drug costs.
See what it costs under that plan every time you go to the doctor. What happens if you go to the hospital? What's that going to cost you out of your own pocket? How much will your drugs cost? You have to kind of make a little spreadsheet almost for each program.
There are websites that can help compare plans, like Medicare.gov, but Hoffland says the best way to get information is to contact the insurer directly and your doctor's billing department. The government contracts with private insurance companies to give seniors lots of choices. Then through Medicare, it subsidizes how much you have to pay. And usually a spouse, family member, or caregiver helps seniors navigate the system.
And then because there are a lot of gaps in original Medicare, a lot of things they don't cover, deductibles, coinsurance, copayments, most people will also need some kind of Medigap policy.
But as Jim Thompson's wife explains the nuances of Medicare, his gaze wanders around the room. He doesn't want Medicare to be like that box in his shop that he can't get open.
I hope that it will be a puzzle that I can unlock.
Thompson is still doing his homework and plans to enroll when his 65th birthday comes around in March. And over the next two decades, more than 75 million seniors are expected to be doing the same thing as they become eligible for Medicare. For Health Dialogues, I'm Kelly Weiss in Sacramento.
You can see photos of Jim Thompson at his shop in Grass Valley and hear more from his conversation about retirement and Medicare with Kelly Weiss. Just head over to our website, healthdialogues.org. Well, almost everyone agrees that the demographic tsunami about to hit Medicare is going to have a big impact on the system. But how? Well, we get two perspectives on that now, starting with Jamie Court. He's president of Consumer Watchdog in Santa Monica. His group pushes for expanding Medicare to make it available for people well before they turn 65. I asked him which issues he sees on the horizon as 78 million baby boomers start using Medicare.
Well, look, Medicare is going to become a place where the healthcare payments for this huge boom are going to be managed. You know, Medicare is a payment system; it's not a system of care. But because we have this huge influx of baby boomers into the program, Medicare is going to get a real reality call real quickly about paying for medical care for an aging population that increasingly demands more and better health care because technology makes it possible. So we are, as a program, in Medicare and as a nation, going to have to grapple with who gets payment for what type of medical care at the end of your life. And Medicare is going to be at the forefront of that battle to try to curb health care costs and yet at the same time not take away realistic choices of helping people live longer for medical care that's proven to save lives.
Now, somebody might hear that and think that raises the specter of what critics call the death panel, you know, rationing essentially.
Well, look, I've been fighting health insurance companies for 20 years, and health insurance companies have utilization review departments and medical directors, and many of us see how they are death panels today because they've rationed care. I think Medicare is going to work a little differently. Medicare is going to make some determinations about what is standard of care for end-of-life treatment and for other types of treatment, and it's going to make a decision whether the people of America can afford to pay for treatments that have a 1 to 2% chance of success. And that's something that's just inevitable. You know, you hear these statistics again and again, but there's the 80-20 rule at rule in medicine as well and in Medicare that, 80% of the money is spent on 20% of the recipients. And generally, that's going to be spent at the end of their life. And it gets harder and harder politically to have these conversations for doctors with patients about what is appropriate and what is inappropriate at end of life. But we will not have a medical care system if at some point we don't make some rational decisions. Now, the difference is Medicare is going to be making them through a public process with comments from the public and scrutiny by Congress. When the decisions of life and death are made by a health insurance company, they're usually made in a windowless room in some corporate headquarters somewhere. So Medicare will be making decisions about what to pay for, just like health insurance companies do. And the reality is they're never great decisions, but at least they're going to be rational decisions made, hopefully, based on our ethical customs and the rule of law and our social mores. I trust Medicare to get that right. And in fact, the healthcare bill specifically bestows upon Medicare the ability to take a look at how we can more legitimately pay for services to make them both higher quality and more cost effective. And that's going to obviously mean saying there's a standard of care and we've got to be careful when we get too far away from it.
Now, on the other hand, the Obama administration recently reversed itself on reimbursing the cost of end-of-life counseling services for Medicare patients. That was something, of course, that was very controversial, the death panel specter that we alluded to earlier. That doesn't bode well, does it?
There's a whole layer of innovation under Medicare that by its very nature is going to take into account this notion that we have to look at what we're paying for and whether it makes sense. For instance, we're going to be looking at holistic care for patients. Rather than the fee for every service, we're going to be looking at people getting paid, doctors getting paid, hospitals getting paid by the procedures they perform. And if there's a hospital readmission because something wasn't done right, they may not get paid for that. But I also think this end-of-life issue is, there's no question it's a really important one, it's also overshadowing the ability of Medicare to be a harbinger of change for bulk purchasing in our medical care system at large. One of the big things that would save the healthcare system a lot of money and the Medicare system explicitly is bulk purchasing of prescription drugs. This was something the president promised on the campaign trail. And if all Medicare recipients, forget the incoming baby boomers right now, if they just bought their prescription drugs in bulk through the Medicare program, through the government, we would see a 66% reduction in the price of prescription drugs.
Well, and I know that's what the VA does. But, as you well know, that all was negotiated away during the healthcare discussions last year.
It was negotiated, according to news reports, between the head of the Pharmaceutical Association in the White House. But many people in Congress don't think that was the right decision.
When you look at the characteristics of the boomers, they tend to be more savvy about healthcare than their parents are or were. They're better informed or sometimes misinformed, depending on where they're getting their information from. They're more demanding, more independent. They're going to live longer. How do those characteristics, do you think, affect the way Medicare is going to be affected by the influx of all these boomers?
Well, we have a generation of very high maintenance, high expectation people reaching a system that needs to adjust to the economic reality of all those people coming in. So it's going to be, without anything else changing, a serious adjustment for those folks who come in expecting that the Medicare system today is going to be the one that took care of their parents. It's going to be a very different Medicare system. However, I think there's some real hope with federal health reform. Medicare is not only going to be the innovator because of federal health reform, but ultimately the states are going to have a lot of latitude in terms of how they use Medicare money. And the states need to use Medicare and Medicaid money in order to make their budgets balance. So I see over the long haul, states like California creating their own Medicare programs. It's something, in fact, Consumer Watchdog, my group's working on with the Nurses Association and others. Can create a California Medicare program that serves everyone before they hit 65 and has the ability to leverage healthcare costs because we have millions or tens of millions of people in a health insurance pool that doesn't include health insurance companies that take a lot away from it. So Medicare operates on a 2% overhead. Let's not forget that that's a very effective system. Health insurers operate on a 20%, 25% overhead. We can save a lot of money if we get everybody into a pool like Medicare. Federally, it's been politically almost impossible to do that, although there was talk during the health reform bill of lowering the Medicare eligibility age to 55, and I think that may come back. At the state level, to the degree that we can innovate with what we would once have called the public option, the public insurance system, and bring Medicare here as a model, a payment model for doctors, hospitals, and drugs that bypasses health insurers, we can save money for the state, and we can ultimately save money for the healthcare system later if uninsured people, you know, are getting treatment today because they're part of a public program. So I think health reform hasn't really shown us how different the healthcare system is going to be yet. As it starts to take effect in 2014, we are going to see, I think, a growth of state-based programs that are called or look like Medicare that may one day even merge with the Medicare system. We are going to see very wise utilization of public funds. And that's going to change the dynamic of the entire healthcare system, including what we think of as traditional Medicare today. Traditional Medicare, as it looks today, there's no question, will not exist in the same form in 10 years. But I think in many ways it'll be better.
All right. That's Jamie Court, president of the nonprofit organization Consumer Watchdog in Santa Monica. He's also author of The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell. Jamie Court, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Scott.
Assuming the new federal health care law continues to be implemented over the next few years, our entire system of delivering and paying for services will no doubt change. I talked with Dr. Arnold Milstein, director of the Clinical Excellence Research Center at Stanford. He sits on a national board that helps set Medicare reimbursement rates. I asked him how Medicare will need to evolve to handle so many new baby boomer patients.
There likely will be two primary changes. First, I think Medicare, in the method by which it pays providers, will begin to tilt its very powerful payment system. I say very powerful just because it's the single largest payer in the U.S. It will begin to tilt its very influential payment system toward a payment system in which doctors and hospitals and other healthcare providers are paid more if they succeed in generating more health per annual dollar of Medicare spending. The second way is they will do something much milder but analogous in relation to Medicare beneficiaries, though this was not a prominent part of the health reform legislation because it is somewhat more politically controversial. But I think it's inevitable that over time, Medicare will need to begin to incentivize Medicare beneficiaries to prefer, when they're selecting a doctor, a hospital, or even a treatment option, such as a drug. So it means, for example, incentivizing Medicare beneficiaries to use doctors who are generating more value per dollar of Medicare health insurance fuel. Same with selection of hospitals, and same when there are two treatment options with fairly similar expected outcomes, Medicare will begin to more strongly incentivize Medicare beneficiaries to select the option that that generates just as much health, but with a lower amount of annual consumption of Medicare spending.
You know, there's a lot of pessimism that some people express about that, you know, the idea of bending the cost curve, you know, slowing down the rate of increase for healthcare costs. How justified is that pessimism?
It's certainly understandable. There's a well-discussed aphorism that, you know, that what is waste or non-valuable care to one man represents income to another man. And I think it is not easy to, in any industry, to reduce the rate of spending. But necessity, in this case, will be the mother of invention. I think that we will, in this state, have a significant advantage because it's a state whose culture and resources are well-oriented to the task of innovating to generate more value.
You're describing it as cost-effectiveness. And yet, when you think about it, 78 million boomers coming into the system, it seems like something is going to have to give, either the eligibility age, the kind of benefit, the range of services, the costs and options for end-of-life care, co-pays, maybe all of those things might have to change, don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, one way of improving the affordability of healthcare is always to thin out benefits. You know, whether it's, there are many ways of doing that. You can increase the deductibles, increase out-of-pocket costs. You can postpone, you know, ages of eligibility, impose a variety of insurance rules. But I think anybody who's ever been in an organization that does that realizes that it's often not politically feasible or difficult politically, you know, in publicly funded programs such as Medicare. Think of that as the last resort that policymakers will turn to after they feel they've done everything in their power to encourage both patients and their clinicians to innovate faster in the discovery of care delivery models that have this property of generating more health with a lower consumption of societal resources.
When you think about the characteristics of baby boomers, they are, you know, some of the most demanding folks in America today. They have very high expectations. How do you reconcile that with the idea of, you know, scaling back coverage or at least incentivizing less use of the healthcare system?
Well, I think the key is not to incentivize less use. That's what, you know, raising deductibles is all about. Rather, it's to incentivize or encourage patients to select doctors and hospitals that are delivering more value per health insurance dollar. That's, I think, much more acceptable to baby boomers. Obviously, if you or I could have our cake and eat it too, that is, live in a society that can afford to give us benefits and in no way incentivize our choosing a particular doctor or hospital, that would be better. I think the best of all conceivable imperfect solutions is going to be to notch up the incentives, both on the doctor and hospital side and on the patient side, to tilt toward higher value care.
All right. Dr. Milstein, thanks so much.
You're very welcome, Scott.
Critics of government programs, including Medicare, say the first way to save money is by cutting waste. Medicare says it has come up with a way to save billions of dollars by doing something fairly simple, forcing suppliers of certain medical equipment to vie for government contracts through competitive bidding. Sounds good, right? Well, as Lauren Whaley reports, the reality is more complicated.
67-year-old Richard Robbins just got a new power wheelchair, and he's hooked up to an oxygen tank 24/7. His life literally depends on the folks who deliver his equipment when he orders it and who get there in a hurry if it breaks.
They know what they're doing. They'll come out and fix my equipment to where I don't go a day without air.
Robbins lives in a tiny cluttered house on a dusty road in Landers, California. It's a Mojave Desert town in San Bernardino County.
But with this bidding part of it, they're going to get people I don't think are qualified, and it really worries me.
This bidding part is a program Medicare launched on January 1st. It is requiring companies that sell things like oxygen tanks, hospital beds, and power wheelchairs to bid for their government contracts. Companies that didn't win a bid will no longer be compensated for equipment they sell to Medicare patients.
We are paying far too much for these products.
Regional Administrator David Sine says just this one program should save Medicare, and therefore taxpayers, $17 billion over the next 10 years. Sine says it's about time the government started paying market prices.
We're paying right now $127 a month to rent a hospital bed. Under the new program, which people bid and offer to do this, they're going to supply that hospital bed for $82 a month.
This is not part of the healthcare overhaul. The competitive bidding program was actually set up by the Bush administration. These new prices took effect in 9 out of 100 regions across the country, including one in the Inland Empire. And if all goes according to plan, over the next 2 years, the bidding program will cover all 100 regions, which will apply to nearly all Medicare recipients. But some folks are skeptical. Esta Willman owns a supply company with her husband in Yucca Valley, another high desert town. She says suppliers are more than a storefront.
It's not something that can be bought on the internet. It doesn't come in the box with the product. So look beyond the box to what really is being provided to the patient.
We're served so good now. What the heck are they trying to do? Take it away?
Esta Willman's customer, Gene Olson, says he would pay out of pocket to keep her delivering his oxygen. But even that loyalty may not be enough.
I predict that initially there's going to be confusion, and then there's going to be a period where it looks like maybe all is well until businesses like ours potentially start to fail. And then by that time, all those people that didn't get contracts, they've already failed. Now the contract holders may fail. Now what happens?
Wilman wonders what will happen to her business since she won only two contracts and lost four. Over the next few months and years, Medicare will have to demonstrate that its new bidding process works for everyone. For Health Dialogues, I'm Lauren Whaley in San Bernardino.
Lauren Whaley joined a team of reporters from the California Healthcare Foundation Center for Health Reporting and the Inland Valley Daily Bulletin to bring us that story. For more information on this collaboration and a list of winning supply companies, go to our website, healthdialogues.org. We'll continue our discussion of baby boomers and Medicare after a short break. You're listening to Health Dialogues.
February edition of Health Dialogues, we look at the complicated relationships we have with food. Why do some people overeat and others crash diet? We'll explore what experts call abnormal eating patterns, as well as disorders such as anorexia and bulimia. That's next month on Health Dialogues.
Welcome back to Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this hour we're looking at what happens to Medicare as the baby boom generation retires, adding tens of millions of patients to the rolls. We may think of boomers as healthy and vigorous, ready for a long retirement, but plenty of them have spent their lives in poverty, without health insurance, and are now entering their senior years with uncontrolled chronic illnesses. As they turn 65, they'll qualify for two types of government health coverage, Medicare and Medicaid. But as Sarah Varney reports, for seniors, trying to figure out which federal or state agency is responsible for which procedures can seem like an almost impossible task.
Health policy wonks have a term for those covered by both Medicare and Medicaid. They call them medi-medis, and their potential for busting state and federal budgets is enormous. While they make up just 16% of beneficiaries, they account for more than a third of all Medicare spending and 40% of Medicaid spending. Of course, some of those higher costs are to be expected. Some medi-medis have suffered debilitating strokes and live in nursing homes. Others have multiple chronic illnesses. And yet, Medicare and Medicaid are often at odds with each other, setting conflicting Kafkaesque rules that drive costs up even more. Marty Lynch constantly has to deal with those conflicting rules. He runs Lifelong Medical Care, a group of health clinics in Berkeley and Oakland.
There's really very little coordination between the different kinds of care that a person needs.
You might need to draw a flowchart to understand this next part. Medicare pays for most medical care, like doctor's visits, hospital stays, and prescription drugs. But it doesn't cover nursing home stays or the kind of care many seniors need at home, like help getting out of bed, bathing, and cooking. That's paid for by Medicaid. Medicaid fills in other gaps as well. It covers copays, over-the-counter drugs, and certain medical equipment. But here's the real messy part. The federal government runs and pays for Medicare 100%. A doctor's bill goes straight to Washington. But Medicaid? The states pay half the bill, and the federal government pays the other half. So the programs are constantly at war, says Lynch, each trying to stick the other with the check.
Medicaid state people will see, well, if we can shift that cost to Medicare, it's less that we're spending, and everybody knows that the state is in a lot of states are in real difficult financial situation. The feds, on the other hand, are happy to shift a few costs over to Medicaid because the state pays part of that.
And that tug of war can lead to some perverse incentives. For example, Medicaid doesn't pay nursing homes extra when their patients get sick. So what do? They're often quick to send patients to the hospital who don't need that level of care because Medicare will pick up the tab. There is a sense, though, that logic may finally prevail in Wonderland. As part of the health law, a new federal office is now cataloging the many inconsistencies that irk patients and providers alike. The list is a long one.
Actually, I'm looking at it right now. It's about 15 pages and growing, very small font, 8-point font.
Sharon Donovan runs the federal effort to make the programs easier and cheaper to run. She says one proposal is to give states the authority and money to administer Medicare, in addition to the Medicaid programs they run now. States could then contract with managed care plans to provide both Medicare and Medicaid services and sort out the bills. Toby Douglas, who oversees California's Department of Healthcare Services, sees great promise in the idea.
They would be responsible for coordinating all the care and receiving one payment that's both for Medicare and Medicaid that would better align the incentives to provide more preventive care, keep individuals out of an institution, and ideally drive down the cost that would result in savings to both the state and the federal government.
These kinds of plans already exist on a limited basis in California, but they're cumbersome to run and financially perilous. One that's had some success is the Inland Empire Health Plan, a nonprofit that covers about 4,500 mostly disabled people in Southern California. CEO Brad Gilbert says the plan essentially gets one lump payment to provide all medical, mental health, and home care. So they take a case management approach to each patient. Primary care doctors, for example, are more focused on prevention and know what tests specialists have ordered. And, says Gilbert, doctors and nurses work in teams to prevent unnecessary emergency room visits.
We're developing a brand new program where we're going to have social workers and nurses contact the members in the hospital, see them in their home, and really make sure that they've got everything they need post-discharge. Because you know what happens is they get discharged, they don't have the medications, they don't have the supplies they need. Guess what? They're right back in the hospital.
Researchers say that kind of attention to health and well-being reduces the suffering of vulnerable patients and ultimately costs less in the long run. Still, there is widespread fear among providers and advocates that states could misappropriate the funds. Karen Davenport, director of health policy for the Center for American Progress, says there would need to be strict safeguards.
So that you're not looking at states which are facing a lot of budget issues using Medicare money to replace what they would have been spending otherwise through the Medicaid program.
But Davenport and others say fixing what's wrong with the dueling systems of Medicare and Medicaid can't simply be about moving money around. Instead, they insist it will require retooling a disjointed delivery system and making sure no one gets left behind. For Health Dialogues, I'm Sarah Varney.
Baby boomers are expected to live even longer than their parents. And with longer life comes more problems associated with aging. But right when boomers' health needs increase, it will become harder for them to find a doctor. Many docs are themselves boomers, so when they retire, who will replace them? And medical schools aren't producing enough primary care doctors, let alone those who specialize in geriatrics. April Domboski reports on the shortage of primary care doctors.
This is Building 80 at San Francisco General Hospital. The waiting room on the fifth floor is packed.
This is one of our dysfunctional primary care clinics.
That's attending physician Tom Bodenheimer.
And it's got two floors, the first floor and the fifth floor, and they are linked by an elevator that may or may not work. And you can't use the stairs. I mean, it's just the architecture is not well suited to team-based care at all.
It's bad news for patients, but the impression left on medical students rotating through is even worse.
They see the lack of continuity of care, and they don't like it.
It's just one experience steering medical students away from careers in primary care. Coming out of med school $100,000 or $200,000 in debt, more and more graduates are choosing to become specialists. Fields like dermatology, radiology, or orthopedics offer more manageable schedules and pay twice or even three times as much as primary care.
As a medical student, I had a couple physicians who said, oh, family medicine? Why would you go into family medicine? You get paid peanuts and there's no prestige in it.
Brian Lang is a third-year primary care resident at SF General.
As a med student, you have to actively seek out mentors to find someone who will encourage you to go into primary care.
60.
Part of the Affordable Care Act is designed to strengthen loan forgiveness programs to ease financial pressure off students who choose primary care. Still, researchers expect there to be a shortfall of 44,000 primary care doctors in the U.S. by 2020. California will be short at least 10,000 doctors by 2020. And by then, half of all baby boomers will be 65 and eligible for Medicare. Finding a primary care doctor could be extremely challenging. Ed O'Neill is the director of the Center for the Health Professions at UC San Francisco. He says geriatricians will be even harder to come by.
Geriatrics oftentimes makes their patients comfortable, but they're not cured from the host of presenting problems and complaints that they have. And that lack of being able to cure or fix or correct probably has played against the interest for physicians to go into geriatrics.
Medical schools are responding by attempting to train all doctors, nurses, and pharmacists in geriatrics. But even that won't solve the problem. O'Neill says Medicare needs to lead the charge by revamping the way it pays doctors. Right now, the fee-for-service system only pays primary care doctors for every 15-minute in-person visit.
That 15-minute visit is really from another century. It's very inefficient. It's not very consumer-oriented.
O'Neill says the current reimbursement system doesn't allow for the use of the many technologies that save patients and doctors time. Doctors can't get paid for using telemedicine systems to consult with patients in rural clinics or at home. And they can't get paid for emails.
It'd be a little bit like saying, gee, I really value that relationship with the teller. I'm not going to go to a bank that has an ATM because I like waiting in line for that interpersonal connection with my teller.
In addition to trying to increase physician supply, researchers are experimenting with new ways of delivering services that take doctors out of the equation altogether.
To begin to incentivize seniors, Medicare enrollees, to move to new alternatives like group visits, home visits, using the internet to manage part of their chronic disease burden.
I don't think doctors are the end-all or be-all of the health system.
That's 80-year-old Lorilla Harris. She says she's been pretty unhappy with Medicare.
It's not a health plan. It's an unhealthy plan. Everywhere I turn, there's a brick wall.
Okay, so everyone has their name tags on.
She's so frustrated with long waits to see a doctor, she's trying an alternative at the Curry Senior Center in San Francisco.
So we're going to go over action plans and other fun things to help you empower yourselves and your health.
This is the first meeting of a six-week healthier living workshop where people learn how to better manage chronic conditions like hypertension, diabetes, and arthritis. There's no doctor here, no nurse. Just health educator Akila Kaday and about 10 other seniors who have come to learn from each other.
Who would like to go next?
This week I'll cut down on sweets. How much? Completely. When? Every day at meal times.
Good. That's a good plan.
The federal government is investing millions to start similar workshops around the country. The hope is that if boomers can manage their own diseases, they won't need to go to the doctor as often. And the shortage of primary care physicians won't seem so bad. For Health Dialogues, I'm April Domboski.
Many baby boomers entering Medicare will bring with them a health problem they've had for many, many years. That's because studies show that about 1 in 10 seniors is a heavy drinker. For most alcoholics, the problem starts in their early 20s. By the time they reach their 60s, alcohol has taken its toll. From KPBS in San Diego, Kenny Goldberg takes a look at the possible implications for Medicare.
After decades of heavy drinking, a man named Pete is trying to kick the habit. He's living at a place in Escondido called Fellowship Center. It's a residential recovery program that incorporates counseling and 12-step meetings. Pete is 64. He's been drinking on and off for 45 years. He used to put away a quart and a half of gin a day.
Yeah, in my 20s and 30s and even my 40s, I thought I was indestructible. I thought I could drink and I thought I could work. And the years took its toll and the alcohol took its toll.
Pete lost his marriage and a job he held for decades. He has arthritis, high cholesterol, and struggles to keep his blood pressure under control. He recently had quadruple bypass surgery. Pete says he's paid a heavy price for being an alcoholic.
It's affected my, obviously, my health, my relationships, my whole life.
Later this year, Pete will enter the Medicare system. so will about 3.5 million other baby boomers. Statistically, more than 35,000 of these people are heavy drinkers. Some abuse other drugs, too. So what does that mean for the Medicare system? Medicare pays for a host of services for people with substance abuse problems, including inpatient treatment and care in a freestanding clinic. The government says it doesn't track the number of seniors who get help for these problems. It also can't provide the amount Medicare spends on addiction-related care. But let's come up with a rough estimate. In 2008, Medicare spent $109 billion on inpatient hospital care. Researchers say about 1% of all Medicare hospitalizations are for alcohol-related diagnoses. So that means in 2008, Medicare spent more than $1 billion on hospital treatment for people with a drinking problem. But that doesn't tell the whole story.
We also see so many other issues associated with alcohol and medical costs associated with alcohol abuse. For example, cirrhosis of the liver, gastrointestinal bleeding.
Dr. Michael Plopper is chief medical officer of San Diego's Sharp Behavioral Health. He oversees substance abuse and mental health treatment at three hospitals. Plopper says some seniors abuse multiple drugs.
With older people, it's become much more common in the last 10 to 15 years for people to become habituated to opiates, particularly OxyContin. So we see complex addictions of alcohol plus opiates, of other drugs. Cocaine use is increasing among the boomers and early seniors.
Dr. Mark Schuchat is former director of the Alcohol and Drug Program for San Diego's VA medical system. He says recovery is tough at any age, but seniors face additional challenges.
Greater likelihood you'll be divorced. Greater likelihood you might be estranged from your children. You might indeed be quite successful in life, but your support group may be a little bit more compressed. And it means that when you come into treatment, there may not be as many people out there who can help you as you go through your recovery.
As Pete continues his recovery, he feels fortunate. His kids are back in his life. Pete doesn't think he'll fall off the wagon.
Well, hopefully, today as I stand here before you, I hopefully will not have that problem. And what I need to do is to stay around AA and the program and the people, so I do stay healthy.
Federal researchers predict by 2020, there will be nearly 4.5 million older substance abusers. That compares to 1.7 million in 2001. For Health Dialogues, I'm Kenny Goldberg in San Diego.
As important as what Medicare covers is what it does not cover. For example, long-term care, like nursing homes, can be very expensive, and yet in most cases, Medicare does not pay for that. To find out more about how seniors and their families can better prepare for healthcare needs in retirement, we talked with Cheryl Phillips. She's the chief medical officer at OnLock, a community-based organization that helps San Francisco Bay Area seniors remain at home. She's also had personal experience with aging parents. I asked her what people should be thinking about as they plan for their later years.
Probably the greatest thing that we look to as we see our aging parents and friends is their medical needs are only part of the story. If you have high blood pressure and you take a high blood pressure medicine, that's only part of what your needs are. What people don't anticipate is often the care needs. We in the medical community call it functional needs, but when you translate it, that means things like, how do I get myself dressed? Who prepares my food? Who does my shopping? What if I can't pay my bills or clean my house? What if I can't get in and out of the bathtub or the shower? How do I think about those kinds of care supports? A lot of times, the seniors, and frankly, we, their children, often don't plan for that part of the aging story.
And that can be expensive.
It can be very expensive. Most of these kinds of services are not covered by Medicare and are not covered by your insurance. In some situations, there is a limited benefit under Medicaid or Medi-Cal, But for the most part, these are services that people all of a sudden are having to pay for themselves, not necessarily thinking about that in advance.
You mentioned Medicaid and Medi-Cal, but of course, to be eligible for those programs, you need to be below the poverty line.
Yes, for Medicaid across the country, and certainly Medi-Cal in California, there is a poverty level that if you make too much money, if you own too many assets, you're not eligible. Part of the challenge, and in many times the crisis for seniors, is they may have a little bit too much money, so they aren't eligible for Medi-Cal, but they certainly wouldn't consider themselves independently wealthy. And when you're living on a fixed income and you're looking at paying for in-home or caregiver services, those can become very expensive very quickly.
Now, boomers, of course, are notoriously independent. We're going to live longer, probably, than our parents did, if we're lucky. We like to have control. We may be working longer as well, and many of us haven't planned for retirement, all those things. So when you look at that population of baby boomers, what kinds of how does that change the way they may deal with retirement or be prepared or unprepared for their later years?
I think one of the very specific changes in our generation, because I'm in that group of boomers, is that we will not go gracefully and willingly into places or facilities that people say we ought to go. We're much more likely to direct services in the context of where we want them and the settings of where we want them and be in control of what we get and how we get it. The challenge will be then who pays for it, and that's been the tension that's been evolving over the last many years. But I think the opportunity for us as this age group coming into retirement is we can start thinking about things like long-term care insurance, like the benefit of the CLASS Act that we can talk a little bit more about how do we set aside money and start thinking and having conversations with our children what our goals are, what our priorities are, and how do we start to access services.
You mentioned the CLASS Act, and of course President Obama signed the health care law, the overhaul, last year. It's beginning to get phased in, and if it doesn't get repealed, it will be phased in by 2014. Describe what the CLASS Act is, because I believe that's part of that, and how it's going to get phased in over time.
Well, I won't get into all of the policy nuances, but in essence, the CLASS Act says that when I am working, I will contribute a small amount of money, maybe $100, $200 a month, to a fund. And after 5 years, if I become eligible, and I don't have to be eligible by age, but if I become eligible because I now have a functional need, we talked about the need for help with dressing, care for yourself, and I want to direct services that allow me to manage my care, I can tap into now the CLASS Act funds. Right now, the benefit is looking, it will be probably around $50 to $75 a day. Not a huge amount of money, but what's different about the CLASS Act is now I, the person, gets to direct how those dollars get spent and what's important to me. And that's a very, very different and I think powerful thing about this CLASS Act benefit.
And of course, we live in a time when we're not even sure what Medicare is going to look like by the time we need it. There's a big gap in terms of the funding of that. So given those uncertainties, how can people prepare?
Well, and I would add further, not only do we not know what Medicare will look like in the future, but there's a lot of misunderstandings about what Medicare is right now. And there is a significant belief system of seniors and often their children that, oh, don't worry, Medicare will pay for it. And it turns out Medicare doesn't. Medicare pays for very specific medical services, but these things that we call custodial or long-term care are not covered by Medicare. There are a number of things that we can start doing. One is, we don't talk much about it, but long-term care insurance. The time to think about long-term care insurance is now when we're young and working, not when we're retired and have multiple medical problems, because then we can't afford it. Long-term care insurance is kind of that one thing that people figure they'll talk about later, but can make a huge difference in the affordability for these kinds of services. We talked a little bit about the CLASS Act. And many families also start talking about set-aside funds just for these kinds of supplemental services that we talked about.
Tell us a little bit more about your mother-in-law and your father-in-law, what they went through.
Well, my in-law's an amazing couple. She was native Greek. They live in Florida. My father-in-law has advanced dementia. My mother-in-law did pass away a year ago. But their struggle was they were the typical, I think, typical aging American couple that says, we don't, one, need any help, thank you very much, and two, we're saving our money for a rainy day, even though we said, Mom and Dad, it's raining right now. As they became more and more limited in their ability to self-care, there was also a considerable fear about bringing in help or losing control of their own lives. Unfortunately, Mom became very ill and ended up in the hospital, now was clearly not able to take care of Dad, went to a nursing home, and we had to make some decisions fairly quickly, particularly my husband, who's an only child, to make some decisions about where Mom and Dad were now going to live. That all happened quickly, without their input for the most part. My mother-in-law was very, very upset, feeling like her life had unraveled around her. On top of that, we had the nerve to take the keys to her car. So she lost her home, her stuff. She reminded me all of her shoes, and I could really relate that that wasn't a good thing. Ended up in a place that she didn't choose to live without the ability to have the independence of driving. Those were really hard changes, and they were all done out of love, but happened in a compressed way that was crisis-driven. Our lesson for us as a family, certainly for my husband and I as we get older, is to start thinking and making those decisions and conversations and engaging our children before the crisis, not when the world is unraveling.
What did you learn from that experience that you are now going to apply to your own life?
Well, one of the things, my husband and I sat down and said, what would we like our aging years to be? And how would we like them to be different? And one of the starting points was to sit down and talk with our kids who are now in their 20s and 30s, who to them aging is just an impossible thought. But we're able to sit down and say, okay, our priorities are to stay at home. These are the assets we would like to spend to do that. But with these kinds of milestones, we may need your help, speaking to our kids, to help us with planning for these kinds of interventions. So it gave us a lesson that part of our responsibility now in our 50s and 60s is to start planning for what our aging will look like in our 70s, 80s, 90s. I plan on being 99 with a full Nordstrom's card going out with a bang, but that's a whole nother story.
And how did your kids react to that?
It's kind of like talking to teenagers about safety. You know, it just doesn't seem like real to them. But certainly our children in Florida who lived very close to their grandparents going through this, they recognize the agony that particularly my mother-in-law went through with these changes that she had so little control over. So I think in many ways they appreciated the conversation that my husband and I had with them about what our priorities were. Now when it actually gets there, I'll probably be fighting and screaming and hanging onto my shoes just like my mother-in-law did.
Dr. Phillips, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And that's all the time we have for this edition of Health Dialogues. Don't forget you'll find tons of good information at our website, including information on signing up for Medicare and deciding which program is right for you. You'll find it all at healthdialogues.org. And while you're there, you can listen to our show, subscribe to the podcast, and of course, you can also get involved in the conversation. And check out our blog. It's called Our State of Health, and it features voices from people in communities all over the state writing about health issues where they live. Again, that's at healthdialogues.org. And be sure to join us in February as Health Dialogues looks at eating disorders. Health Dialogues is a production of the California Report and KQED Public Radio. The director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is our engineer. Additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The Health Dialogues team includes senior online editor Gabriel Cohen, web producer Nick Budinsky, and outreach coordinator Shuka Kalantari. The senior producer is Polly Stryker. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report's Health Dialogue series are provided by the California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens.
More information at calendow.org. And the members of KQED Public Radio.